On this episode of The Mincing Rascals, you'll hear the Rascals mince about the mass exodus of people leaving Chicago and the state of Illinois, those long TSA lines, and the latest in Clinton versus Trump.
Today is Friday. It's the 20th of May, 2016. We are the Mincing Rascals, and I'm John Williams.
I'm Steve Bertrand, the host of The Business Lunch on WGN.
And I'm Kristen McQuarrie, a member of the Chicago Tribune editorial board.
Kristen writes a column twice a month for the Tribune, and you can hear me Saturdays from 1 to 3 here on WGN Radio.
You think she could do more, really?
Well, she does, but I don't want to say because it's competitive. She appears on other podcasts sometimes, that Kristen McQuarrie.
I do. Don't tell anyone.
And by the way, you can also hear this podcast broadcast in part Saturdays at 1:30. Here on WGN Radio, 3,000 people flee the city of Chicago, says the headline. 6,000 have left the metro. So in a few decades at this rate, and it's a big if, we might now not be the second city, we'll be the fourth to Houston, which will be number three. Should we care, Steve?
Houston's the biggest city I don't want to go to.
But people are going.
I know. I mean, we were talking about this story, and it's like, I love to travel. I love to see new things. There's nothing I would want to go to Houston. No reason I would want to go to Houston.
You don't like humidity?
Right.
Not that we don't have enough of that in Chicago.
Tex-Mex. I like Tex-Mex. But
you like not paying income taxes?
Well,
that's
I
one
do,
reason.
No, I like to pay my fair share.
You do?
Yeah. No, really, though. I found myself going, no, come on. I don't want to lose more ground. And then I thought, that's kind of a stupid attitude. You know, should we? It almost like was a matter of civic pride, Steve. I wanted to be the third largest city, not the fourth.
Well, because we're called the second city, and pretty soon it's going to get silly.
Yeah, right. You know?
But what struck me about that story was, I mean, people focused on the city part of it, but it was really a region-wide, right? I mean, from the state
and the metro. 6,000
exactly.
Left the metro.
So from southern Wisconsin into northwest Indiana, when you look at all of those numbers, there was a net loss.
And do you attribute a lot of that to just the dysfunction of the state? Because I know the Democrats like to downplay that, and they say it's the weather, it's this, it's that. I get emails every week from people who are leaving Illinois because of the dysfunction of government officials.
And are they
here.
Really? Do they really leave?
They do. I mean, yeah. They're writing me from Texas and Arizona and Florida, and yes, I mean.
Well, the Tribune ran a story this week. They found a chiropractor in, I think, Houston, and he was standing there looking all happy to have left Chicago. I don't really think people do that. I mean, you hate the fact that government is corrupt and taxes are high, but can you imagine, Steve, saying, that's it, we're out of here because too many of our governors are in jail? I don't think that happens.
No.
No, but I live in the city, and I'm staring at the largest property tax hike in the city's history this fall. That is only going to be a drop in the bucket to fixing all of the problems with the city's finances. So I do think that plays into it. And part of that story led with the fact that middle-class black families are
yes.
leaving and have left.
Yes,
and
I noticed
have been,
that.
I mean, that has been an obvious factor in my neighborhood for the 15 years that we've lived there. The people who have the means to get out they're leaving. And there's really no denying that. I mean, Chatham, some stable black neighborhoods on the south side are, you know, emptying out.
Well, that was Phil Rosenthal's point, too. He had an op-ed piece or a column in the Chicago Tribune today, Friday, and he said, we should focus on quality, not quantity. Don't worry about the numbers, but worry about the quality of life that people are leading. In fact, your piece in Friday's Trib was kind of interesting too, of course, Kristen. I don't know if you wrote the headline. I suppose you didn't, but it said we should have a playbill, not an agenda, for city council meetings. What was the point of that?
Well, the city council approved more borrowing on Wednesday during the meeting. It got very little attention. The Trib did cover it on Monday as it passed through Finance Committee, but it's just become almost not news anymore that the city is just basically functioning on a credit card. A lot of the borrowing was for infrastructure, but some of it is just to cover day-to-day expenses because we still don't have our finances under control. And city council is just an embarrassment of egos. I got fed up waiting 2.5 hours for the actual agenda to begin with Alderman Ed Burke and others who just like to stand and pontificate and use that time, that precious time, to promote themselves. And that's why I've suggested that you should hand out playbills instead of agendas, because it's just, it's theater. It's ridiculous, in my opinion.
Really, it's not entertaining at all. Because I've never been to a city council meeting, and I could tell that you were in a 2.5-hour meeting you did not appreciate.
What do they do? They bring they introduce the classes and, you know, the award winner from the 49th Ward and all
they
of that.
They do resolutions, yeah. Right, at first. Yeah. You know,
right.
Normally
really?
You leave that to the end of the meeting. But you have people who have taken the bus to come downtown to watch something or to have an impact on something else that's on the agenda. They're taking time off of work. They're in parking garages with the meter running. I mean, it's rude. It's rude. And nobody wants to stand up to Ed Burke because he's the influential finance committee chairman and this is the way the city does it. But you know what? It's rude. And that's pretty much what I...
Well, and then you said they all vote, and was it 49-0, the vote to borrow the money, and that gave you pause. It doesn't sound like you even think that was a really good idea.
Well, no. I mean, all of these aldermen ran for office last year promising to not do any more scoop and toss borrowing, which they just approved back in January.
Yeah, where did you find the campaign promises, the quotes from aldermen? I mean, I don't think it's fair to hold them up when you're running for alderman, Kristen, to their campaign pledges and promises.
Not?
No, they're just aldermen. They just say stuff.
When does the promise thing kick in?
We shouldn't hold them accountable. They're aldermen. It doesn't count. Yeah, it was interesting. I never heard those quotes before.
Well, because we do see, I have all of their questionnaires. When we do endorsements, we have them fill out a questionnaire.
Oh.
So it's in writing, and I keep those. I keep them for state legislators. I keep them for the governor, for the mayor. And I like to go back and remind them of what they said as candidates.
And they said, we are not going to kick the can down the road. What is it? Toss and burn? What's the phrase that they use?
Scoop and toss, but toss and burn works, too.
Yeah, right.
It's when you borrow money to pay off retiring debts that are coming forth with more debt. You borrow more to pay for what is coming due. That's scoop and toss.
And that's what we continue to do, though you and there was quote after quote from these people saying, I'm not going to do that anymore. Nope, you elect me. That won't happen. 49-0. Boom, it just happened.
Right. Yeah, 46-0.
46.
But who's counting?
Well, yeah, don't hold me accountable. The same week that lines at Midway and O'Hare stretched to 3 hours, an Egypt Air plane crashed or vanished off the coast of Greece. Do U.S. commuters have any business complaining then? You know, the juxtaposition of those two is interesting, isn't it? Because we're upset that it takes so long to get through lines.
Well,
but maybe...
okay, yes, but it's not as if we're waiting to get through lines because the measures of security have been stepped up. They're the same as they were 6 months ago, essentially. It's just that the staffing isn't there, and also that we're trying to sneak our bigger bags on and carry on.
Yeah, what did you think of that demonstration TSA did, Steve? I suppose you heard about that. They took about 20 or so, 10 TSA volunteers. They walked them through the line, you know, doing the things we all do, bags that are too big, things that need to be removed. And then they walked the same volunteers through, and this time they were all compliant. And the line went 3 times faster when the passengers do what they're supposed to do at the checkpoint.
I've been that. Asshole, am I allowed to say that? Who forgot, you know, forgets to take my laptop
out.
Oh,
that part won't be on Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, mark the tape.
All right. I'm that absent-minded person who holds up the line because I'll forget to take my laptop. And so, yes, part of it is passengers not following the rules.
But that seems to be passing the buck. Steve is right. I mean, something new has happened here. We're understaffed. It's a busier season. They thought that 25 million people would have signed up for the TSA check that would get you through more quickly, and only 7 million have.
Okay, so Ryan Burrell, the WGN reporter this week, needed to do it himself. And frankly, I wanted to do it, and clearly it's not going to work now.
Well, you should, Steve. Well, I mean,
I
you travel
no, John,
a lot.
John, he went to do it downtown, and he was fortunate enough to get there before, I think it was 9:30, when they cut off walk-ins for the day.
And he was really?
There, and he was there for 6 hours to get his interview to get pre-selected. The appointments that they allocate at that particular office are now full through July. So the idea of getting a pre-check as a solution isn't really viable now. That process is just as jammed up.
Man, this is government running things. You know, this is, I mean, and you know, and I think this will be unsatisfying. But if you are upset with somebody and you want to yell at somebody, who do you yell at? It's clearly not the person that's checking you at the airport. It's your congressman. I mean, they're the ones who really didn't sufficiently fund this. That's my understanding anyway. Do you guys see it that way too?
I don't know. I've heard so many different theories. There's another theory that TSA is in the middle of contract negotiations, and so they purposely were encouraging people to call in sick to give them more leverage at the bargaining table. So I don't have a good answer. I think it's probably all of the above.
I think it's Hillary Clinton.
Thanks, Obama.
Yeah, there you go. I interviewed that kid who posted the video, that young man who posted the video that went viral. 2 million views of him walking the line at Midway. The same weekend that 450 people had to sleep overnight at O'Hare and miss their flights. And he said that while they were all standing in line, and you know, that thing is epic, right? It goes on for minutes. It takes him to walk to the end of the line and took a couple hours to get through. And he said about halfway through that line, a door, you know, in the vestibule there opens up and out walk from like a break room about a half a dozen TSA people. And they look at the crowd and the crowd looks at them and the TSA people go like, whoa, hey, how about this? Ooh, we'd better, you know, and there was some sort of happy banter on their part. It was not returned in kind by the people. They said, yeah, why don't you guys get to work here? But they're just understaffed. It's so incompetent what's happening at the airport.
Yeah, in my travels, I also think that they could use a little cheering up training or, you know, cheerfulness training. I don't think that's the best interaction between passenger and TSA agent.
Do you want that job?
No.
I'm
already grumpy, and I would be a grumpy.
People videotaping you with their phones, watching you touch their kids inappropriately, and then posting it online. I love those people, you know.
I went through one day last year, and the security guards were being very rude and almost mean to people who didn't speak English. Mm. And they weren't, you know, they were foreign tourists or whatever. They weren't being helpful to them, trying to get them through. And then they were looking at the rest of the people like, look at these idiots, you know, that sort of stuff that is above and beyond. Do I want the job? No. But I just wonder if they were a little more cheerful, if things might go better, too.
If that Egypt Air crash was an explosion, if it was a terrorist, you know, I'll be very interested to find out how they got through security in Paris. How did that happen? Mm-hmm. Steve, you and I have just been through. I was there a couple of weeks ago, and security there seemed to be every bit as intense as it is here. So we'll wait and see. We will have to wait and see. And yet Donald Trump tweeted almost immediately after the plane was missing, looks like yet another terrorist attack. Airplane departed from Paris. When will we get tough, smart, and vigilant? Great hate and sickness was his tweet. And then he tweeted after that, a plane got blown out of the sky. And if anyone doesn't think it was blown out of the sky, you're 100% wrong.
Yeah, he spoke those words.
That's a quote? Yeah, okay, yeah. I'm reading here, obviously. Sure. I saw the tweet of the first one. The second one was him on TV. Huh?
Yeah.
And then let me just finish with what Hillary Clinton said on CNN. She said that Donald Trump says, quote, a lot of things that are provocative that actually make the important task of building this coalition, bringing everybody to the table, and defeating terrorism more difficult. So each of them have sort of managed this in their own style. She was cautious and reserved at first, and now she's saying that Donald Trump is demonstrating that he makes things worse. I don't know if we should talk more about that or more about the plane crash itself, but you sure do see the difference between the two.
You do, and I mean, I thought, so she, and in this interview with CNN, they made a big deal of her finally saying he is unqualified. She had sort of hedged around that before, and finally she came out and said it. And they tried to make this into, you know, a big story. I just thought it was sort of ridiculous. People have been saying that for the past year.
I think she wanted to make it a story, too, because she started fundraising on it right away.
Yes,
so, I mean, I wonder if it was her strategy.
On him not being qualified?
Right, with using that language. Mm-hmm. Right,
really? Oh, that strikes you as strident or strong or
no,
meaningful?
No, just calculated.
Yeah,
you know, I think the whole thing was
we're going to roll the unqualified stuff out today.
Well, yeah, but I mean, so what's the difference between that and any other race? Normally, they would say I would be a better candidate, but she's saying he's wholly unqualified, and that's deemed significant, huh?
For whatever reason, I think because she has been so cautious and she's so messaged, I just felt like the whole CNN interview was set up. They're like, okay, she's ask her the question because she's going to give you the answer this time, and it was really just a big deal out of nothing, in my opinion. And she was here. She was in Park Ridge and her hometown when
at
she made
Pickwick
that.
At the Theater.
She was.
Then so Donald Trump, of course, took that and said that Hillary Clinton said he should not be allowed to run for office.
Which is
not at all what she said, but it's what he said she said, so that's what matters.
Well, then he said her response was dumb. I think he just kept calling it.
Welcome to, it's funny, times are critical. They're always critical. There's always a crisis. You know, it's always important to be the president, and it's just amazing how silly this gets. And I'm telling you guys, I'm just, Hillary, if your ears find this podcast, please don't go there. Please don't give him a nickname. Please don't respond to every stupid tweet. Don't go there. Please.
He called her husband a rapist this week.
I wouldn't respond to that.
She hasn't. There's actually a New York Times piece, I think, up today where they kind of walk through all of these things, and you can see where she's going to take all of this, and it's really just not addressing it.
The high road can win this election. The high road can win this. The Trump people will, vote for Trump no matter what, but there's plenty of people who don't love either of them but will see the high road and take it.
Well, I think that could be what does her in. I mean, because he's going to have his anti-vote, but she's not necessarily going to pick it up. I mean, her unfavorable ratings are pretty high as well. Her favorable ratings, I think, are in the mid-20s, right about where Donald Trump's are.
I wonder once Bernie Sanders officially gets out, though, and she coalesces that group. I mean, she says, I think in this New York Times piece, what they have in common is Trump. And they will eventually, come to her corner. And I think you'll see those numbers going up.
He is just doing her damage, don't you think?
Sanders is?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why?
He is.
Why do you say that?
Well, because he's actively campaigning against her still when it's clear he can't win. I mean, this would be like Ted Cruz campaigning in Oregon or whatever.
He has 10
Bernie
million
Sanders,
votes.
So
10
what?
Million
so
people
what?
Have
he
only
can't win. He
13,
cannot win.
He can't win. And that's why they're tearing down places like Nevada, because the game is rigged and he's angry about it and his supporters are too.
Okay, but he still can't win. And if he, and if he wants Donald Trump to lose, he should continue to campaign for his ideas and for his message, but not against Hillary Clinton or not against the Democratic machine that is going to get her elected.
Do you believe the poll that says that he can beat Donald Trump more handily than Hillary can?
No.
The latest poll says that.
I don't believe it.
And it doesn't matter because everyone knows he's not going to. You know, it's easier to say he could when you know you're not going to have to vote for him.
Right.
What do you make of the New York Times story last Sunday? It was, at that point, and I'm sure this fact has not changed, the most read and the most shared story online for the New York Times this year. Granted, it's May, but it was the biggest thing the Times has done in 2016. It was the story of how Donald Trump treats women in private, was their point. Any thoughts about that, Kristen? Do you think that was a legitimate story, or was that the media showing its bias?
I think it was a legitimate story, but a couple of the women have said that they were cast incorrectly, that the comments that they made were taken out of context. So I do think they sort of started with a narrative, and then they made sure that they created that narrative at whatever cost. But do we all not think that Trump was a playboy? Of course he was. I mean, he's on his third marriage. And as far as that behavior, yes, it's, if true, reprehensible. But we already elected Bill Clinton, who, had numerous affairs. That was a huge part of, his presidency and this cloud that loomed over. So I just kind of feel like we've already crossed that threshold. I don't know how much more offended we're supposed to be.
The weird thing is that Trump brags about it. You know, he brags about the women who want to sleep with him or the prominent women who he's bedded, he writes about in his books and things like that. There's a difference there. I thought about the article was that it just showed a very complex man. I mean, it's some very positive things when it comes to Trump and women. That's right.
The head of his construction firm or his real estate development business was a woman.
Right. Who he said loves the candy. So he promotes her. He treats her very well and respects her and then disrespects her in other ways.
I think the Times showed their hand, though, when they told the story about, remember the date he meets this, he has a party. 50 models, 30 guys. Perfect Donald Trump party, right? And it's at Mar del Lago, and he's walking around, and he meets this one woman, and he says, wow, you are striking. And so he starts to escort her around, and he says to her, do you have a swimsuit? She says, I don't. He has women's bikinis there. He said, here, would you try this on? And she does. And he said, that's a stunning Trump girl. And then he parades her about the party, saying, check out this stunning Trump girl. That's the way the New York Times told the story. She goes on Fox the next day and tells the story the exact same way. There's no difference between the two. But in the story, two paragraphs after that description I just gave you, the New York Times describes that as debasing. And her point was, I did not feel debased. Now, you could argue that maybe she doesn't know that she's being debased, but the point is, the New York Times described it as demeaning to her, and she said, I wasn't demeaned at all. I had a great time. She dated after that.
Dating him, right, mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought it was a weak way to start the article when there's so much stuff that we all knew. But flip it around. Imagine if it was Hillary Clinton at a pool party in Chappaqua, and she finds this, you know, young, good-looking kid and says, here, I've got a Speedo. Why don't you put it on? You know, and then she walks around. Could you imagine that?
Well, she's single in this story, right, Steve?
I don't know.
This is a very complicated what if for me. I'm having trouble understanding your point there.
I just ate breakfast, too. I don't
need to. What I'm saying, I guess, is that what is acceptable behavior now in the Trump world is so unacceptable everywhere else that we forget that.
It's not just the Trump world, though. It's the world. I mean, these are the same questions we dealt with Bill Clinton or with womanizing in general. It's very, very lopsided.
Okay, there you go again. So is that fair game? Are we going to, as we consider Donald Trump the president and cad, do we have to remind ourselves that Bill Clinton was in office, too? Are those the same things?
I see them as the same things. I mean, just the idea.
You see that, Bill Clinton's treatment of women or his persona the same as you see Donald Trump's?
Not their persona, but if we're talking about just in general, womanizing, having affairs, using women, sleeping around, they are, you know, on the same playing field, I think. And I mean, look at he's considering Newt Gingrich for his vice presidential candidate, who was the same, you know, family man on the outside, not so much behind
the
scenes.
Okay, so can we separate infidelities from treatment of women? Or is that possible? And I ask because...
Well, his treatment of Monica Lewinsky was reprehensible.
Okay.
It was off the charts.
I know, but I want to move beyond the sexual improprieties, and we'll give them equal measure there. But then we've got the way Donald Trump refers to Rosie O'Donnell or talks to other women or, you know, is critical of women by their looks. Is that separate from infidelity, or is it all one bag?
I think they're different.
Yeah, they're different.
Well, so then there is a difference
between he and Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
And their,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know what Bill Clinton was saying behind the scenes. This is a very different world of what we're.
Don's not talking behind the scenes.
You don't think Clinton was?
I'm saying, patting
himself on the back for all the women that he
maybe, but
bedded.
Donald Trump isn't saying it behind the scenes. He's tweeting out to his millions of followers that Rosie O'Donnell's a pig.
Oh, I know. I'm not defending his sophomoric frat house reprehensible behavior. I mean, I think that's been well documented. I don't think that's defensible at all. Not just against women, but against, the reporter that he mocked who was disabled and on and on and on down the list.
Okay, but then one last thing. So is it fair game, would you say, and in even Donald Trump's world, to use Bill Clinton's past as a campaign point?
I see it as if Hillary Clinton is going to use that, and she hasn't really. This has come from others.
Use what?
Use Trump's infidelity as womanizing as a way to sort of take him down. Yes, it puts her in a very awkward position.
But she's not. Assume she doesn't. Is it fair for him to start with that? No, right?
I don't know.
Well, she didn't have the affair. She's not the one that had oral sex with Monica Lewinsky in the White House, right?
Please, woman.
I know, really. I mean, that is Bill Clinton. That is not Hillary Clinton. I got to tell you, I'm thunderstruck by this. You cannot equate the two.
No, I read My Life, Bill Clinton's very long book, and he goes into great detail about his behavior and how, you know, he misled his wife and he lied to her. And then she was on national television calling it a Republican conspiracy when, in fact, you know, he was sleeping around and he did have this relationship with Monica Lewinsky. So, I mean, that whole segment of their life together is, if we're going to explore the relevancy of what Donald Trump does and who he sleeps in, what his reputation is or whatever, then why isn't it not also part of the narrative of Hillary Clinton?
Well, because one's running for president and one's married to someone who did it. Right. I mean, there is that difference, isn't there?
I mean, right. I see the intersection, but they're different directions. Hillary didn't do it. Bill did.
Right.
Bill's
right.
not running for president. I want what you guys and I, none of us did last week, which was a recommendation that is cocktail based, wine or beer based. Can you guys do this for me this time?
Gosh, I brought a song this week.
Okay, well, let's do this because I promised that we would.
Okay.
I have a drink.
Great.
You can do a song, and Steve, you can do a dance.
Okay, awesome.
Okay, so here are our recommendations this week. I'll go first. The Barefoot Contessa Whiskey Sour. Doesn't this sound like a good kind of summer drink?
The Barefoot Contessa.
My wife... We're having people over tonight.
Is Brenda, Ina Garten coming?
Brenda has made this concoction. So you want to hear it?
Yes.
It's a cup of lemon lime juice. It's a half cup of fresh lemon juice, a half cup of fresh lime juice. So you got 1 cup lemon lime, 3/4 cup whiskey. We prefer the Jack Daniels. Mm-hmm. And then 2/3 cup simple syrup, you know, sugar water. And you mix that up and then you put maybe an orange or two rind, slice on there, serve it with a maraschino cherry, and they'll carry you out on their shoulders.
Is it too sweet? It sounds a little bit too, maybe with the sweet and the sour.
Yeah, so I was sipping it this morning to get the taste of it, and I thought it was a little sour, but I think you can adjust the levels of ingredients to taste. Mm. You might want to put in a lot more Jack Daniels, Kristen.
I will. I prefer Irish whiskey, but I'm with you.
Okay, so what's your song?
So I'm one of these people who once, when I get a song that I love, I listen to it, 100 times, and then I move on to the next song. So my favorite song now is James Bay, Let It Go. Are you familiar?
No, sing it for us.
No. I will not sing it, but I'll just tell you and our listeners, if you want to hear just a song where he kind of gets raw in his vocal cords, and it's just a really lovely song. It's on the
He's like a soulful Brit, right? He's a young British singer.
He is. And so Let It Go by James Bay.
Steve Bertrand, what's your recommendation this week?
All right, I'm going to go back to TV because I've been watching now. I have a buddy who talked me into signing up for Amazon Prime, and I started watching Mozart in the Jungle, which was this series that got a lot of Golden Globe Awards. And Bernal, the Mexican actor who was in Y Tu Mama Tambien and a lot of other films that you've seen. It plays this young conductor, this phenom who takes over the New York Philharmonic Orchestra or the symphony. I really should have thought this through before I started. But
me too.
So it's like
the
this,
whole show.
It's like this artist who comes in and disrupts this very staid symphony. Maybe you call it a comedy, a dramedy. I'm not sure, but I'm really enjoying it. Mozart in the Jungle.
You could have just said Whiskey Sours, and it would have been a lot easier.
Bloody Mary.
Here's this. I'm playing the song as we fade to black here.
All right, this remarkably low-tech performance of the Mincing Rascals concludes now with Kristen McQuarrie, I believe, holding her cell phone up to the microphone.
No, it's her close-and-play.
A close-and-play. How retro.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Of course you don't. You're under 100. That's...
Come on, let it be.
Kristen McQuarrie, thank God this is over from the Chicago Tribune. And Steve Bertrand from WGN Radio.
Eric Zorn is hitting his windshield right now.
And guess what, Eric? I want to thank our producer, Kristen Decker, who was thinking, I could have just mixed that music in post-production, guys, and Bob Ferguson could have too, our engineer. But thank you all. And remember, you can hear this podcast broadcast in part without the word asshole on WGN Radio Saturdays at 1:30. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. You can also listen online on the WGN Plus app or WGNplus.com. The Mincing Rascals podcast is a presentation of the WGN Plus podcast network. You can also catch highlights every Saturday from 1:30 to 2 p.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.